Nelson, a company with the Radisson Hotels and TGI Fridays brands. He resigned that title Sunday to take his new post. Best Buy has been struggling all year, in part from self-inflicted wounds. Former CEO Brian Dunn resigned earlier this year, along with the company's chairman, after Dunn had an affair with a female employee. Apart from that, its business has been losing to online competition, which can afford to sell products cheaper because they don't have the same enormous real estate costs. Meanwhile, Best Buy's founder and largest shareholder is also in the process of trying to take over the company. Jolie is expected to start his job in early September. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Dow's down 14 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. 100 years ago this summer, American explorer Hiram Bingham first set eyes on the ancient city of Machu Picchu. This find made Bingham world famous, but in more recent years, he has been denounced as both a liar and a thief. Our guest for this hour, writer Mark Adams, not an adventurer himself, hoped to discover the truth about Bingham, and he decided to do it by retracing the explorer's steps. This morning, this hour Focus, Mark Adams will be telling the story of his trek through the Andes in search of the truth behind the legend of the lost city. And this is the story that you will find in his book, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. Dutton is the publisher. The book's just out here recently. Mark Adams is also the author of the acclaimed history Mr. America, which was named by the Washington Post a best book of 2009. He's a writer for many national magazines, including GQ, Outside, and National Geographic Adventure. And Mark Adams, hello.
Hi, David. How
are
you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You left off the most important part of my biography.
Which is?
I was a graduate of the University of Illinois.
I did not know that. I'm not sure that I have that in any of the material that I have about you.
I know.
It's again, good to know that someone can graduate from the University of Illinois and go on to greatness.
And when I find that person, I'll let you
Yeah, do that. Well, anyway, I appreciate very much you spending some time with us. Just before going into the story and your story and talking about Hiram Bingham,
yeah.
I have not myself had the experience of going. All I know of Machu Picchu is from what I've seen in photographs.
Sure.
But even seeing it in photographs, seeing the place, getting a sense for the setting, there is something about it. You look at it and you think, well, this place can't be real.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just, I would imagine that actually being there and standing there, it's even more an overwhelming kind of thing.
Well, the thing is, the Incas were a sort of clan who put together the largest empire in the Western Hemisphere in the 1400s into the 1500s. They ruled most of the west coast of South America. And what they're most famous for today is their incredible engineering, their great building techniques. But what is equally impressive was their work as landscape architects. And, you know, there's Machu Picchu, but there are also several other Inca sites that are still in existence. And the thing that unifies all of them, in addition to this incredible stonework, is just the amazing scenery that they chose for each of these sites. And, you know, it's hard to get that completely about Machu Picchu until you walk out there and you sort of turn the corner and you see that, you know, wow, this city is sort of nestled in this jewel box surrounded by mountains and clouds and mist and everything. It's just, it's absolutely jaw-dropping.
Yeah, and certainly it's a very popular destination for, I suppose one might call it adventure tourism. Although it's not like climbing Mount Everest because you can take a train from Cusco and get there. But it's not exactly like going to going to Disneyland.
No, it's about halfway between.
So,
you know, I mean, you have to at least go out of your way to get there. Yeah. You know, you have to fly to Lima, the capital of Peru, then you have to fly to Cusco, and then you have to take a 3.5-hour train ride. You know, the more adventurous way to do it is to take the Inca Trail, which is sort of the famous, one of the world's great treks, in which you can walk 4 or 5 days from one Inca site down this incredible sort of winding trail that many believe was a pilgrimage route that ends at Machu Picchu. And that's a much more satisfying way to arrive.
Yeah, and that is the way that you went.
That's one of the ways I went. I actually, you know, what happened was I decided to follow Hiram Bingham, the fellow who found Machu Picchu, located it in 1911. I wanted to follow the route of his 1911 expedition, which is one of the great expeditions in history. He found not only Machu Picchu, but two other incredible Inca sites. And I sort of followed his trail, which is sort of a circle that goes around Machu Picchu and then ends up at the Lost City. And that took about a month. It was a little off the beaten path. I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but it was a way to get a great sense of what Bingham had seen 100 years ago when he was looking for Machu Picchu.
Yeah. The just one other thing that just generally about the place, in addition to I'm sure that it's breathtakingly beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's something that's really stunning about just standing there and turning around in a circle and looking. That there is something people who have been there say, that there is some. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it's the altitude and maybe it's the scenery, but they say there is some special feeling to the place, some very spiritual vibe that the place has.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a pretty secular guy, but when I got there, you could tell that this place had been built as sort of a natural cathedral. You know, it just gives off that sense. And it was built on very sacred ground to the Incas. You know, the primary theory these days is that it had been built as sort of a country estate, like the Camp David, for one of the greatest Inca emperors, a fellow named Pachacutec, who was sort of the Alexander the Great of the Incas, who started their great expansion in the 1400s. But it's also quite obviously this sort of sacred natural site, and you know, like I said, you can just sort of feel something there as you can in certain places in the world.
Mm. Let's talk here some about Hiram Bingham.
Sure.
He was a lecturer at Yale. He was not specifically or particularly an archaeologist.
No, no.
What was it that made him want to go to South America?
He was a specialist in South American history. That's how he ended up in South America. And what happened was he went to this scientific symposium in Chile in 1908 and 1909, and was sort of touring around looking for some details that he could put into a travel book. And he made his first trip to Peru. And when he got to Cusco, which was the former capital of the Inca Empire, the holy city, had, you know, at one time perhaps been the most extraordinary city in the world, but was now sort of a run-down regional capital, he was set off on sort of a sidetrack when a local prefect said, "Hey, you're an expert on South American history. Please come with me and look at these ruins that we're essentially blowing up with TNT here, you know, 50 miles outside of Cusco, and let me know what you think." So he said, "Okay, fine. You know, I'm here with a delegation, so I might as well do what everybody wants me to do." And he got out there, and that's where he first heard the story of the lost city of the Incas, which supposedly was this place that, you know, when Pizarro arrived with his not-so-merry band of conquistadors in 1532, a group of Incas had, according to legend, run off to this city high in the mountains, hidden with all their treasure and their holy women, and then as they died out, the location of the city died with them. So Bingham quickly sussed out that the location he was looking at in 1909 was not the lost city of the Incas, but he went back to Yale, he did all sorts of research, and realized that the actual lost city was a place called Vilcabamba, and he had a pretty good sense of where it might be, and that's what got him back there in 1911. He definitely was ambitious to make a name for himself as an explorer, not just a historian.
Well, and that gets at one of the features of the story that I think some people who are not so sure about Bingham would point out, that, in fact, the Lost City wasn't lost. There are a lot of people who knew where it was, and that Bingham himself, contrary to his story about just having stumbled on it, in fact,
right.
in fact knew where it was. He had
sure.
a map. He knew what he was looking for.
Right. Well, Bingham was a terrific detective. So what happened is when he got to Cusco in 1911 to look for the lost city, for Vilcabamba, he started asking around to anyone who had been up and down the Urubamba River Valley, which is the main sort of whitewater river that runs near Cusco. And a few people told him, you know, look, we don't know anything about it, but if you go up high on this mountain ridge down the valley here, there's supposedly some interesting stuff there. So when he got there, on his way to the place that he thought might be Vilcabamba, which is down in the jungle, he stopped at a local inn, and the innkeeper said, yeah, I can take you up there tomorrow. And he went up there the next day with, you know, moderate expectations. But when he got up there, there were three families of farmers living there, and one of them set one of their little boys to say, you know, okay, take this tall 6'4" white man for a tour of the ruins that he might be interested in. And lo and behold, they walked around those famous terraces, and voila, there was Machu Picchu. Mm-hmm. So it was not a total shock. He knew something was up there, but he definitely didn't know that it was the Machu Picchu that we know now.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things that perhaps makes Machu Picchu and some of these other sites really so special is that it is intact, and that there are many other places. I think even at Bingham's time, there were many other places that were being torn up.
Yeah.
And that in large part, people were going in there and they were just tearing things down because they thought there would be buried treasure there.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, it's all around the world, people have always torn down ruins looking for buried treasure. Mm-hmm. And the Incas certainly had a reputation for burying idols and precious metals with their dead. So, you know, I mean, when he got to Machu Picchu, he spent one day there in 1911, and he brought a whole crew back in 1912 to sort of excavate. And that's what got him into trouble later. Mm-hmm. But when he was up there in 1912, he didn't find any treasure or any valuables. People had already picked Machu Picchu clean. The extraordinary thing about Machu Picchu was that, like you said, the buildings were still intact, and they looked essentially like they must have when they were put up 500 years earlier.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Adams, and we are talking about his book, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. It's recently published by Dutton. He is a writer, has worked for a number of national publications, GQ, Outside, National Geographic Adventure. He's joining us this morning by phone. Questions, welcome. Maybe there's someone out there who's listening to us who has been to Machu Picchu who would want to tell us about the experience or whatever questions you have. That's great. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, will-talk@illinois.edu, if you'd like to do it that way. Well, you freely admit that you have been an adventure journalist. You have written about adventure travel and have worked in some of these publications where they, like the National Geographic Adventure, where they specialize in it, but that you yourself, I think you freely admit that before this, the last time you had slept in a tent was when you were a kid in the backyard of the house where you grew up, so that you were not a big adventurer yourself.
No.
What made you want to set out on this trek?
Well, you know, it was two things. It was one, sort of, you know, reaching midlife and realizing that I'd been, you know, sending these writers, since I worked as an editor, I would send these writers off to Kilimanjaro and Kathmandu, and they would have their adventures and then send everything back, and I would help them move the words around on the page. You know, well, I worked out of a midtown Manhattan high-rise, and that I had never actually gone off and had one of these adventures of my own. You know, the other thing was that 50 years after he died, Bingham's name popped up twice in the news in 2008. The first time was when the government of Peru decided to sue Yale University to get back some artifacts that Bingham had taken from Machu Picchu. And the second time was when an amateur researcher in Alaska, a fellow named Paulo Greer, published his map showing that a German had probably gotten to Machu Picchu before Bingham, and therefore, you know, not only could he not make a claim of being the discoverer, but he really couldn't make the claim to be the first outsider to have made it up there either.
Hmm.
So, you know, seeing all these things coming together, I sensed that there might be a story there. And as it turned out, I was correct.
And you yourself have a connection with Peru in as much as your wife is Peruvian?
Yes, my wife's, her mother's side of the family is from Peru. So we would go to Peru, we'd go to Lima, the capital city, which is essentially like Los Angeles, you know, they've got smog alerts and valet parking and Starbucks. But we'd never been to the Andes, and the Andes are a very different place from Lima.
Yeah.
You know, this is a place where, you know, the culture is still sort of straddling ancient nature worship and Catholicism. You know, they speak Spanish and they also speak Quechua. We got a little bit off the tourist trail outside of Machu Picchu, and, you know, in some places it could have been, we could have stepped back in time a century or even two centuries. You know, there are people plowing their potato fields with sticks and things like that.
Yeah.
It's a much different world.
Well, and I gather that one of the things that perhaps makes Peru as a country special is that it has an its terrain and ecosystems are extremely varied, and just on almost anything you could quite imagine, maybe not almost anything, but a huge range of conditions. You can find them all within the borders of this one country.
Exactly. I mean, the weather and topography in Peru, if they're not the most varied in the world, they've certainly got to be near the top of the list. You know, I mean, this is where El Nino comes from, off the coast of Peru. Because the shelf falls off so quickly there, and that the hot, warm water mixes with the cool. And then, you know, on the land of Peru, you've got this sort of small strip of land, and then the second tallest mountain range in the world. So you've got glaciers crashing up against the Amazon basin. It's just, you know, it's some of the wildest terrain in the entire world. There were days when we would wake up and the ground would be frozen beneath us. You know, we could walk up to a 15,000-foot mountain pass, and then we'd walk down an old Inca staircase more than a mile, and by lunchtime, we were sweating because it was 85 degrees and humid.
Wow.
So that's just the kind of place Peru is.
Yeah. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. We'll do that in Urbana, line one.
Oh, hi, and I apologize. I just was able to turn on the radio and heard about this, but I'm sorry. I apologize if some of this is redundant, and I think you were asking for folks who had been to Machu Picchu.
Sure.
I have not, but my sister has, and I tried to get her to call, and it's just not working out, so I just wanted to relate some of the experience. She went about 2 or 3 years ago, and she was under age 50, and she said she was very glad she did it then, that she would not have waited much longer to visit Machu Picchu because people severely underestimate the physical requirements in order to be able to accomplish it. She went with a very reputable tour company, and I know at least one person, if not two, actually broke their legs on the trek up. And I don't fault the tour company because she said that she was the youngest person. She was just under age 50, and she was the youngest person in the group, and that there were a lot of people who were in their 70s and 80s who had no business trying to take on Machu Picchu at that age. So.
Yeah.
You know, she said basically as a forewarning, if you're going to do it sooner rather than later. And she also advised me as an asthmatic that I could not do it because she had to spend several days, I guess, at elevation where they drank some sort of, I want to say it's like a coca tea or something like that.
Exactly.
And she said without that, she would not have made it. And she is not an insignificant, you know, or out-of-shape person. And I think sometimes these pragmatic observations kind of get lost in the spirituality of it. And she said, you know, she said it was kind of ridiculous. There were these 70 and 80-year-old people trying to tackle Machu Picchu. And she was, you know, below 50 and she was being challenged.
Sure.
And again, when somebody falls off the trail and breaks their leg, I mean, you know, I think that people need to kind of get a little over the fantasy of it and deal with the pragmatic realities of it.
Yeah, it's so beautiful in the photographs that you don't stop and think, you know, there are no escalators at Machu Picchu. You know, and it's built on a mountain ridge, so that means staircase after staircase after staircase. And above and beyond that, if you try to take on the Inca Trail, which a lot of people do without preparing, and I walked it myself and saw a lot of this, you know, there are days when you're walking down a mile and then you're walking up a mile. You know, it's like going to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and coming back up again. So you really do have to be prepared. And the other thing that you mentioned is the coca tea, and that's what they have you drink in Cusco. The typical advice is to have you fly into Cusco, which is at over 2 miles altitude. I think it's 11,700 feet, and to acclimate for 3 days to get used to the altitude because the high altitude pulmonary edemas are a very serious problem there. You know, a lot of people have died. They've gone out on the trail and not realized that they were susceptible to this. And actually chewing coca leaves or drinking the coca tea does sort of alleviate the symptoms of altitude sickness, or soroche, as they call it in Peru.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I always appreciate this program, but I just wanted to sort of pass that along because I've had friends sort of wax rhapsodical, have this rapturous idea that they're going to retire and go hike Machu Picchu.
Yeah, it's not like walking to Stonehenge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. You're going to get some work in your thighs.
Right. Exactly. Well, or a pulmonary embolism.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much.
All right. Well, I thank you for the report. Other questions or stories are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And again, if you'd like to write us an email, you can do that too. will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, also in the book here, as you explain your decision to go there, you realize that you really, to do this, you couldn't just do this completely on your own. You needed to have a guide, someone who was really experienced. And you found a guy who sounds like, if you can imagine what a guide should be, if you were going to hike the Andes, it sounds like this would be the guy.
He is the man. He's quite an incredible man, John Levers. He's an Australian expatriate. I actually just got an email from him the other day telling me that he was going off on his own, as he tends to do, with a backpack full of dried food, searching for new pre-Columbian ruins that no one has seen before. John is about 58 years old now. He's in incredibly good shape, and he's sort of a throwback to the pre-Lonely Planet era of travel, where, before luxury started coming into it. So many people who go to Machu Picchu now are into it for the restaurants and the hotels and things like that. And that, that is not John's bag at all. He used to lead tour companies, groups across Asia and Africa in the 1980s and early 1990s, driving an old World War II Bedford truck, which is sort of an open-back truck, and, had to essentially deal with everything from terrorists to uprisings and malaria and everything like that. So he was ready for just about anything, and thank goodness for that, because I was ready for just about nothing.
There's, in fact, there's a in the section of photos in the book, there's here one page where there's a picture. There are two pictures on top here. There's a picture of Hiram Bingham, and then there's a picture of John Levers, and it looks to me like these two guys would belong together. Like, you can imagine the two of those guys actually heading out together.
Absolutely. They both have a look on their face that says, look, we're looking for something here, so you're welcome to join us, but you're going to have to keep up.
Yeah, exactly. So here's another caller, someone also in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have two comments and a question. One, I visited Machu Picchu with some friends in 2005, and people ask me what it's like. I'd like to say that if you had taken all these structures, the buildings, and put them in a cornfield, it would be an incredible thing to see, just because of the engineering and how these things were put together. And if you had gone, if there was nothing in this valley that you look at in the mountains there, if Machu Picchu wasn't there, it's just this physical scenery, that would be worth a visit. And when you put these two things together, it's just incredible. It's just the combination of the engineering and the buildings and that scenery.
Yeah, so definitely a 2 + 2 = 5 effect.
Absolutely. So that's one way of describing it. Another thing I want to mention is that going to Cusco first and spending a number of days at 11,000, 12,000 feet, there's another way of doing it. And we flew into Cusco, but we didn't stay there. We took a taxi right down to another town. I think it's Ollantaytambo, I can't remember.
Sure.
And there you can get the train the same day.
Yeah, that is another way to do it.
Yeah, and this way, Machu Picchu is only like 2,000 meters or 6,000 feet. Like Denver, it's really no big deal. So you can visit it, and then you can go back to Cusco and then get used to the altitude. So that's, I think, is another way of handling it.
No, that's true. Yeah, Machu Picchu itself is about 8,000 feet. The city at the base there, Aguas Calientes, sometimes called Machu Picchu Pueblo, that's about 6,000 feet. So you're getting, not real high, but high enough where you might feel a little bit woozy if you're coming from sea level.
Yeah, but we didn't have a problem doing it that way. Although we did feel it, back in Cusco for sure.
Yeah, that's a big
hiking
difference.
Around there.
Yeah.
My question is, what did Bingham actually see when he got there? Did he, all these things were overgrown, and he saw a few buildings. Did he have an idea of the extent of it? Do we know what he actually saw on his first visit?
Well, Bingham actually took a tour with this, I think 8 or 9 year old boy that was not unlike a tour you might take with a guide at Machu Picchu today. He went through that sort of main gate. He was shown the Sun Temple, which is this beautiful white granite structure that's sort of circular in shape, probably the most beautiful building at Machu Picchu. And then below it is this incredible cave with all sorts of abstract carvings inside of it. He gave it that cave the name the Royal Mausoleum. Then the boy took him up the stairs, and they looked at what's now known as the Sacred Plaza, which is where those three temples with the gigantic blocks of stone wedged so closely together are. Mm-hmm. And then the boy took him up to the very top of the main ruins there, where probably the most famous part of Machu Picchu, the Intihuatana stone, is. And he took some photos up there, probably the first of millions of souvenir photos next to the Intihuatana stone. And by the time he'd seen all that, the sun was starting to go down. He had to get back to the inn at the down by the river. So he saw the highlights of Machu Picchu. By no means did he see everything. And a lot of it was overgrown. He said, what was incredible is that these buildings, at least the finest stonework, were largely intact. But some of them had, mature trees growing on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of stuff to be cleared out, and yet these buildings had been so well made 500 or 600 years ago that they were still standing.
Yeah, all right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll go to Belgium for another caller here, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you, too. Ever since I first heard the word Machu Picchu, it's enthralled me, and I've never been there. I don't know if earlier in your show you said what Machu Picchu means. I'm sure it has some sort of meaning. But the question or thoughts I had really about calling you about is that right now, about 1 million people a year go to Machu Picchu?
Mm-hmm.
And Machu Picchu is really being beat apart by that many people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should take notice of that.
Yeah. Well, the United Nations several years ago came out and said, I think 1,800 people was the limit it could handle without being ground up. And I've actually heard that within the last week, the local government, the people in charge of Machu Picchu, sort of unilaterally put a limit of 2,500 people a day at Machu Picchu. So there were all sorts of angry people in Cusco who couldn't get into Machu Picchu because it's always sort of been, an unwritten rule that if you can get yourself to Machu Picchu, you can get in, no matter how many people get in there. Apparently, that's going to change now. There is a new president of Peru as of just a few days ago, so maybe he's putting some new rules in effect. As for the name of Machu Picchu, it just means old peak. Yeah, there's two, as you may recall, there's that mountain that's sort of in the rear of a classic Machu Picchu photograph, that sort of green rhino horn.
Mm-hmm.
That's known as Huayna Picchu, young peak. So, the Incas were terrifically innovative with their building and not so innovative with their names.
Now, this Machu Picchu is the name that the Incas gave it, not something...
No, the only name that we may... No, the Incas called it by is Patayacta, which means high place.
I see.
But we're not sure about that. That's one reference that showed up in a Spanish chronicler's histories that was actually lost for about 400 years. It just showed up in a library in Ibiza, Spain, about 20 years ago. So, but we don't know if that was just a placeholder name or the original name or what. A lot of this stuff is lost to history because the Incas didn't use the written word. The only recording devices that they used were called quipus, which were these sort of knotted cords. And most of those were destroyed by Spanish decree, but the few hundred that still remain were still trying to decode what they meant. We don't know if they contain histories or if they were just like abacuses or what. I mean, it's starting to look like they contained a lot more information than anyone has ever imagined.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Mark Adams, the author of the book Turn Right at Machu Picchu. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, thousands of accessories, and private lessons at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Mark Adams, author of the book Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. E.P. Dutton is the publisher. He has written for many national magazines, among them GQ, Outside, National Geographic, Adventure. And this book is the result of his interest in exploring the story of Hiram Bingham, an American who was said, at least in his time, to be the discoverer of the lost city of Machu Picchu. He became internationally famous as a result. Some people say, in fact, that Bingham was part of the inspiration for the character of Indiana Jones. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. And Mark Adams decided he wanted to try to get more into the life of Bingham, and also to go and see the place and perhaps do it by retracing the path that Bingham took. And that's what the book is about. Now, we have another caller here, somebody up in Chicago. So we'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Mark. I was wondering if you knew anything about Hiram Bingham's reputation within his own family when he was a young man.
Well, he was an only child. He comes from a very interesting family. His grandfather, Hiram the First, was one of the first missionaries to get to Hawaii and try to convert the natives to Christianity. And in fact, Hiram the First founded the Punahou School, from which President Barack Obama graduated. He also built the first great cathedral in Honolulu, a name of which I'm not going to try to pronounce, but it's still there and it's still very famous. And his own father, Hiram II, sort of tried to copy his father's success by going to a place called the Gilbert Islands, which is sort of a peppering of little islands in the South Pacific. Only a few thousand people lived there, and Hiram II spent 34 years translating the Bible into Gilbertese before he finally got it published. So I think Hiram III, being the only child of two very strict Calvinist parents, realized two things. One, he also wanted to make a name for himself in the world, but realized that he was not going to do it by translating an obscure language for the Bible. And the other thing was that he wanted to get the heck out of his house. So he tried to actually escape from his parents by buying a ticket on a steamer when he was 12 years old out of Honolulu, and was caught at the last minute when his partner in crime spilled the beans to his own father. But he was obviously a very, very ambitious young man from the get-go and very hardworking. You know, he went to I think Phillips Andover Academy, was a poor student, poor in terms of money at a wealthy children's school, and made a lot of his tuition money by tutoring other people and working in a boarding house while also keeping his grades up high enough to get himself into Yale. So, he was a focused and fascinating young man, but he, above all, always wanted to be famous.
Yeah, I'm married to a distant in-law of his.
Yeah.
My wife's great aunt, her mother was a cousin of Hiram Bingham's father, Hiram Bingham II.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never heard that story of him trying to escape when he was 12.
Oh, yeah.
My recollection, I've read a number of letters that our great aunt's mother had written when she visited Honolulu in 1898, I think.
Yeah.
And she had mentioned that Uncle Hiram and whatever his wife's name was, I forget, were very worried about young Hiram.
Yeah, well, that was around the time when he started losing his religion. He actually, I think that's right about the time when he came back to Honolulu for 1 year and tried to run the mission there. And he just sort of burned out in 6 months and had to tell his father, look, I'm not cut out for this.
Yeah, the stories that I've gotten about him was that, although he had a very good reputation in America in general, He obviously didn't live up to some of their expectations. Neither did my great-aunt's mother, who had been – she grew up in Michigan, but she
yes.
was promised when she was born that she would be sent to help out with teaching in Honolulu, and she rebelled against that when she was 14. She couldn't imagine moving to such primitive backwater.
It was a hard place back then, so that's completely understandable.
Well, thanks for the story. I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
I want to talk some more about Bingham. And
yeah.
we talked earlier about the, you know, his claim was that he was the first person in a long time to get to Machu Picchu,
sure.
which is clearly not, you know, as we said, it wasn't lost. A lot of people knew that it was there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's maybe come into some disrepute. For that, but a bigger thing is the accusation that he was he took stuff,
right.
He took artifacts from there, took them back to the United States, and just recently the government of Peru, relatively recently the government of Peru, and they were at Yale. The government of Peru said to Yale, "We'd kind of like to have this stuff back." So
right.
What exactly is the truth of all of this?
Well, what happened with those particular artifacts is, you know, Bingham located Machu Picchu in 1911. Almost immediately made plans with Yale and the then very young National Geographic Society to go back and get some artifacts, some antiquities, to put in the Peabody Museum at Yale. So he went back in 1912, just 6 months later after he had returned to Yale, and essentially started strip mining Machu Picchu. You know, he hired a bunch of local laborers. And what he found was, you know, mostly pottery, much of it broken, and human remains. But, you know, he very carefully boxed this stuff up and made a map of where he'd found everything. And about halfway through his expedition, he had made, with the help of President William Howard Taft, he'd made sort of a handshake deal with the president of Peru saying, you know, I realize you don't want us to take this stuff out of the country, but, you know, why don't we just split it up? And, you know, we'll work out the details later. But Peru being Peru, there was an overthrow of the government while he was out at Machu Picchu and out of touch. He got back to Cusco and found out that his buddy in Lima, the president, was no longer in charge, and there was now a leftist in charge who found his whole idea of taking the stuff from Machu Picchu to be an abomination. So it looked like Bingham was not going to be able to take anything at all. And then at the very last minute, the new president said, I'll tell you what, you can take whatever you want, but the moment we ask for it back, you have to send it back. So Bingham, you know, saw that he had to hit an opening, and he got his stuff out of there as quickly as he could. So what happened is over the years, Peru, you know, early on made a few overtures to get the stuff back. Bingham was busy. World War II came up. He was, you know, one of the early majors in the Flying Corps in France. He went on to a political career in which took him to the governorship of Connecticut and later the U.S. Senate. You know, so he had other things on his mind. And then over the decades, Peru, and to tell the truth, Yale forgot about this stuff as well. It sat in the basement of the Peabody Museum for decades. And then only about 30 years ago did a couple of new young scholars there take a real serious interest in it. Well, about 5 years ago, Peru started making noise about getting this stuff back again, and that's where, you know, Bingham's reputation as maybe as, you know, some sort of grave robber came up. A lot of it was for political purposes, and he definitely could have sent the stuff back and never really got around to it. But I think he probably got a worse reputation than he deserved on that account.
Mm.
You know, that said, there's another guy who wrote a book named Christopher Heaney who found some evidence that Bingham had purchased some black market antiquities that were better than the things he found at Machu Picchu and smuggled those out of Peru. So he definitely deserves a slap on the wrist for that.
What about the Indiana Jones connection? How does one make the connection between Bingham, the real life guy, and this the wonderful character that we've come to know and love?
Well, what happened is Bingham wrote two versions of the Machu Picchu story. He wrote one in 1922, not long after he got back, and then he wrote one in 1948 called Lost City of the Incas. And that one, you know, he was a man in his late 70s. He was obviously trying to establish his credentials for posterity. And that's the book in which he said, you know, look, I found Machu Picchu, and he didn't really share credit with anybody. And that has come to be the most famous telling of the story. so a few years after Lost City of the Incas came out, I discovered that some guys out in Hollywood had pitched a movie called Lost City of the Incas. This was based on Bingham's book. It was about a Yale archaeologist who goes to Machu Picchu and is looking for the great Inca sun disk. I think they had been inspired by the success of a movie called King Solomon's Mines. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do something similar. Well, over the years, the story sort of got watered down and became something else, possibly because Bingham would have sued the pants off of them. But it became something called Secret of the Incas. And this is a 1954 B-movie starring Charlton Heston. You actually watch the whole thing on YouTube if you want. It's in the public domain. And in this movie, you know, the costume director for Raiders of the Lost Ark has said point blank, look, we watched Secret of the Incas over and over to get the look of Indiana Jones.
Yeah, the hat and the jacket,
the hat,
all
the
that stuff.
That leather
yes.
jacket.
Heston
exactly.
is that 100%.
Exactly, for inspiration.
Yeah.
But what I found a lot more interesting was there are scenes in Secret of the Incas, such as one where Harry Steele, the main character, uses this Inca mirror to reflect a beam of light that shows the location of the sun disk, that you could tell Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were just having some fun just recreating these shots almost, you know, scene by scene and frame by frame in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, I mean, you can if you trace it all the way back, you can say, you know, is Indiana Jones Hiram Bingham? No. But if Hiram Bingham had never written The Lost City of the Incas, would we have Indiana Jones as we know him now? No.
Our guest is Mark Adams. He is the author of the book Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City, One Step at a Time. We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, going back to Machu Picchu, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that people who go there, it's an awesome kind of place just mm-hmm. because of the setting, but also people feel that there is this kind of spiritual vibe mm-hmm. to it. And one of the big questions that people have mulled over, and I don't know that anybody has got a really good answer, but people have provided answers, is, well, what was this for? Why was it built? Why was it built there? And was there some particular significance that connected with Inca spiritual practice?
Right. Well, you know, the sort of generally accepted theory is that it was built as a country estate. But there's also another theory put forth by a fellow named Johann Reinhard, who is famous for about 15 years ago, he found an intact frozen Inca mummy on a mountaintop in Peru at about 20,000 feet, actually brought it back. It was known as the Ice Princess. And he's put together a theory he calls the Sacred Center, which, if you go to Machu Picchu, makes complete sense. Standing at Machu Picchu, directly to the north, south, east, and west are sacred peaks, or apus, as they're known in Quechua, the local language. Mountains are very sacred in ancient Inca cosmology. There's also the Urubamba River that sort of wraps itself around the rock outcrop on which Machu Picchu is built, almost hugging it. And then it's also built in the territory where the Andes crash into the Amazon, which is a very sacred ground. As I put it in the book, you know, if there were a Geiger counter for sacred territory in the Inca Empire, the spot where Machu Picchu was built would bury the needle. It was quite obviously built there, and you can actually see this on one day a year, on the June solstice. The sun rises above a peak directly to the east, sort of hovers above the top of the peak for a moment and glows like the halo around Jesus' head in a Renaissance painting, and then fires a beam of light through one of the windows at the Sun Temple, which is that beautiful round building at Machu Picchu. And this sort of rectangle of light forms on this round slab of granite, and in the middle, there's a chunk missing. And there was obviously something there back in the Inca times, but what it was, we may never know. I would love to know what was on that slab of granite.
We have another caller here. Let's get them line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. Was curious. I understand Hiram Bingham sold Machu Picchu kind of as Vilcabamba, the lost city of the Incas.
Yes.
And I'm wondering when, now they think it's more of a royal estate.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, when did the ideas on that start to change?
After he died. His personality was so big that no one really challenged him. He claimed that Machu Picchu was not only Vilcabamba, which is the original lost city of the Incas for which he was looking. He claimed it was also a place called Tampu Tocco, which is the birthplace of the Incas, according to legend. So, you know, it's as if a Bible scholar found a nice-looking hill outside of Jerusalem and said, you know what, this is not only the Garden of Eden, but Mount Calvary, where Jesus was crucified. So he tried to pack all of his findings into one place. The truth is, you know, he didn't know what Machu Picchu was. And about 10 years after he died, a fellow named Jean Savoy, who was a famous explorer, went down into the jungle to a place called Espiritu Pampa, which Bingham had actually visited for a couple days, but was unimpressed, and he was exhausted because it's down in the jungle, it was raining, there were bugs, and he really couldn't see much. But Savoy went down there with 30 macheteros, these guys with machetes, and sort of cut the place apart and realized, oh my God, there's a whole city here in the jungle. And that's generally believed to be Vilcabamba now, the lost city of the Incas.
But you say also that for example, Cusco is supposedly what the navel of their universe. I mean,
yes.
How did he interpret Cusco?
As a holy city. You know, he never doubted that Cusco had been, you know, this important holy city. You know, the famous thing about Cusco is that the roads into the four quarters of the empire all sort of converged in Cusco, and that was also where the Coricancha was, the very famous sun temple, which some of it is still standing. But at the time when the Spaniards arrived, it was covered with a 2-foot-wide band of gold. And this is a large building. It's almost, you know, the size of like a basketball arena. So it must have been absolutely spectacular to see back in its glory.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. We have a couple of minutes left. If somebody wants to call real quick, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, what did this experience mean?
You know, what it meant was that I could finally, you know, get a grasp of what Machu Picchu had been. Because, you know, working as an adventure travel editor, you read stories about Machu Picchu all the time, but you don't really get a sense of what it had been. And, you know, looking into the history and following Bingham's footsteps and, you know, sort of getting there on my own 2 feet, you really got a sense of how majestic this thing must have been, and still is. But just the idea, the audacity to take this sort of jagged, you know, notch between two mountain peaks, essentially landfill it, and then build this incredible city on top of it. As John Levers, my guide, said, it was almost as if the Incas were saying, you know, look at what we can do. Look how we can tame nature. And I think that, to a certain extent, was what they had in mind. They wanted to show their reverence to nature, and they also wanted to show to the whole world, you know, look at what we can do.
And you, I think when you were starting out, I think you were also interested in the character of Hiram Bingham, somebody who, when he was in his day, when he was alive, he was one of the most famous explorers in the world, and that was saying something, given who his competition were. And yet here we have someone who has taken down more than a peg since, with these allegations that, well, first of all, that he really didn't discover anything,
right?
And secondly, that he was a thief, so he was a liar and a thief, and certainly not this great man that perhaps people thought he was at the time. So you thought, well, here maybe there's a pretty good story also here, looking at
right.
how over time people have changed the way they thought about this man. So how do you feel that you came away with some kind of insight into who Hiram Bingham really was?
He did. I mean, he was a complicated guy. He did good things. He did bad things. You know, I mean, at the end of his life, he was in charge of administering, you know, loyalty oaths for the House Un-American Activities Committee. So, you know, there are worse things that he did besides fudge the truth about Machu Picchu. But what I think about Bingham vis-a-vis Machu Picchu is that, you know, he's the guy who, you know, whether he discovered it or found it or located it or whatever verb you want to use, he is the guy who got up there, saw it, appreciated it for what it was, even if his theory about Vilcabamba was wrong, and then publicized it to the world through National Geographic magazine and made it so famous that no one could go up there and knock those beautiful buildings down looking for the gold that was no longer there. You know, he preserved Machu Picchu for the rest of us, and he absolutely deserves credit for that.
So now, after this experience, if for you, is that significant adventure travel, or did that make you think, well, maybe I might want to go and do something like that again?
Did it whet my appetite? No. I think that's about the most extreme thing I'm going to be doing.
Okay. Well, I think it's a great story, and I'm sure that for you, you know, not only did you learn some interesting things about the place and about this guy, but I'm sure that for you as an individual, one doesn't do this and come away unchanged by the experience.
No. You know, and to go into these situations and you know, to hike through these valleys and canyons and cross the rivers and, you know, do it under your own 2 feet, and to, you know, get away from email for a month and you know, just see these amazing things out in nature as looking as they were hundreds of years ago. Yeah, it definitely changes you. You know, it makes you appreciate the things that you have yet to see, and you realize that if you just put a little effort into it, you can probably get a little further out of your comfort zone than you ever imagined.
It's a good story. It's Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. Dutton is the publisher, by our guest, Mark Adams. And Mark, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Coming up on tomorrow's program in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, a conversation with archaeologist Brian Adams from the Prairie Research Institute at the Illinois Archaeological Survey at the University of Illinois about his book, Joseph William Royer, Urbana's Architect. It's a rebroadcast from June of this year. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, we'll listen back to a conversation from March of 2010 with award-winning science writer Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. On Wednesday's show, conversation with Cornell University Professor of English Robert Morgan, author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, followed by a conversation from May of 2010 with writer Nathaniel Philbrick, author of The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. That's what's ahead on Focus in the next couple of days. Coming up next here on WILL AM 580 is an hour of news and information from the Afternoon Magazine. We'll have news from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media. Among the stories we'll tell you about, we'll talk about the global economy and just how important exports are to the U.S. economy. Jim Meadows will have a report on the UC2B Big Broadband Project here in Champaign-Urbana. Among the other stories we're following at this hour, an Indianapolis public school spokesman says the district is not having any busing problems as students return to school today for the first time since about 80 bus drivers called in sick as part of a protest. We'll tell you about what those bus drivers were protesting. Chicago teachers are picketing at a handful of schools today. We'll find out why. Also, this summer's intense heat and drought has already put stress on Illinois' lakes and rivers. Well, now water is being released from the state's power plants, and that could be making it worse. We'll have details. Let's update you now on what's happening in the commodity market, starting with Kansas City wheat for September, trading at 885 and three quarters, up a quarter. December wheat's at 910 and a quarter, up a half. Chicago wheat for September is at 877, up 2.5. December wheat at 898.5, up 4. September corn's at 814, up 15.5. December corn at 821.5, up 14.25. March 2013 corn at 821.5, up 13.75. May corn at 814.25, up 13.75. September soybeans trading at 1696.25, up 25.25. November beans at 1673.25, up 27.5. January beans at 1663, up 26. And March 2013.